Chapter 14. Life's Greatest Lesson. The Only Assurance of Long-Term Success. In any role in life, including negotiation, there's a direct correlation between our self-image and our performance. We consistently perform to the level of our self-image. Our world was built by men and women of high self-esteem. In negotiation, it is absolutely required if you're to succeed. It is self-esteem that gives you the confidence to face down debilitating neediness, to swallow false pride, to make tough decisions, to act in the many challenging ways I've discussed throughout these pages. This last chapter in my book is as important as any of them. Is it clear that there's no contradiction between having high self-esteem and allowing your adversary to be okay? Self-esteem is your internal appraisal of yourself as an individual, and nothing can affect it. Okayness is your public presentation of yourself. The difference is huge, obviously. Your own high self-esteem is exactly what allows you to allow your adversary to have all the okayness in the negotiation. Self-esteem keeps you in the fight when you face overwhelming odds. With it, no situation can keep you from seeing yourself as a strong person, a capable person, a deserving person, a successful person. High self-image gives us the strength to endure high levels of success. It confirms your desire to fulfill your capabilities. It demands that you be paid full measure for work rendered. It is your high self-image that won't allow you to sleep if you don't do the right thing. On the other hand, those of us with low self-image will not pay the price of victory. We will quit. Bill Gates did not take on the federal government while burdened with low self-esteem. In fact, I challenge anyone to find examples of greatness in any field produced by individuals with low self-esteem. Think of the child who's called clumsy by the critical parent, told he has two left feet. What success would you expect of this child in the role of athlete? Not much. How many children have you known who wouldn't even try an activity out of fear of embarrassment? How many children are called dumb at a young age? How many embrace dumb as a self-image and prove it true? How many times have you heard someone say, "I just can't see myself doing that"? But what if they say, "I'm going to do everything I can to do that"? Which person has the self-image that will give him or her a chance to make their dream come true? I'm not a fatalist. I do not believe our destinies are set in stone by age 3 or even 30. Certainly, early successes and failures play a role in the development of self-esteem, but anyone can achieve, maintain, and deserve a much higher self-image if he or she is committed to the task. And this observation brings me to the main point of this chapter, paying forward, which I introduce with a final story about Coach Woody Hayes. In 1975, Ohio State played a great Michigan team coached by Bo Schembechler. It was a typical Woody versus Bo matchup, both teams undefeated and rated among the top three teams in the nation. This was a championship prize fight, with two tough heavyweights trying to knock each other out. Through the first 3.5 quarters, it was a close game. Then, late in the fourth quarter, Ohio State All-American Ray Griffin intercepted a Michigan pass and returned it to the 3-yard line. What a knockout blow. Buckeye fans went nuts, of course, not only in Ann Arbor where the game was played, but around the world. Once again, Ohio State was on the way to the Rose Bowl. When the team returned to Columbus from Ann Arbor, it was met at the airport by some 20,000 fans. To signify the victory and the upcoming appearance in Pasadena, a group of these fans gave a dozen red roses to each of the women who had traveled with the team in any capacity. Then, Coach Hayes did a strange thing. He immediately confiscated all the roses and put them in his El Camino truck. No one understood what he was doing, nor was he telling. In fact, he never did say what he did with the flowers. Only later did I learn that he had driven, with only 5 hours of sleep the night before, from hospital to hospital in Columbus, presenting a rose to every terminally ill patient he could find, until the flowers ran out. Coach Hayes was putting into practice the lesson learned explicitly from Emerson and taught implicitly by the great religions of the world, the lesson he had taught his players at Ohio State and everyone else he dealt with all over the country. In this world, you must pay forward, because you can't really pay others back, not sufficiently. With those roses distributed in the hospital on the day after the great victory, Coach Hayes was paying forward. Pay It Forward was the title of a film in 2000 which combined this idea with that of a chain letter. Do you remember the feelings you had as a child when you received presents? You were thrilled. But as thrilled as you might have been to receive, do you remember when you went out and earned your very own money and took those hard-earned dollars and bought someone you loved a present? How good did it feel when that person became excited? I once gave my devoted grandmother an oil painting of a seascape. She was so overwhelmed she cried. It was the most thrilling day of my life. Why do the wealthy give their money away? They can't take it with them, it's true, and they want to avoid taxes, and many don't want to bestow too much on their children, smart thinking. But they also do it to feel better about themselves. The very wealthy can have self-image problems like everyone else. Philanthropy is paying forward. Tithing to a house of worship is paying forward. So is patriotic sacrifice. So is sleeping in hospitals with the wounded, as President Lincoln did. Queen Isabella I of Spain was paying forward when she wrote a check to Columbus to go explore the unknown over 500 years ago. An old man in Iowa, the owner of a large grain elevator, was paying forward when he told a young man working in a gas station that he would pay for his college tuition if he promised to work hard. This was during the Great Depression. Without this assistance, the young man would have stayed at that gas station in all likelihood. With this aid, Roy M. Cotman went to Ohio State, eventually became Dean of Agriculture at The Ohio State University, and played a major role in the development of hybrid corns that increased yields fourfold and helped to feed the world. There's nothing new in these paragraphs. The context may be unusual, but I'm speaking of age-old wisdom. Achievement requires self-esteem, and to build self-esteem, you only need to start paying forward. To pay forward more effectively, at every opportunity, with your family and friends, in the workplace, in your community, in your house of worship, everywhere. And then, you should pay forward some more. You will reap the benefit in every aspect of your life, including most definitely the negotiating table. Throughout this book, I've discussed attitudes and behaviors and activities vital for negotiation success. Paying forward is as important as any of them. It's the most dramatic way to see yourself as a good person, a successful person, a contributor to society. It's the most dramatic way to be this individual. Paying forward is the secret for creating self-esteem, no matter what your age or circumstances. Anyone can pay forward. There are absolutely no excuses on this one. You can even pay forward in the bare-knuckles world of business. In illustration, I want to tell one final story. This story goes back to the mid-1950s, when the Queen of England decided to put up for sale the land she owned in the Lake Muskoka region of Ontario, Canada. This land had never been owned by any white man before the Queen. It had been taken from the original Canadians by treaty. My dad bid for a lot, sight unseen, on Go Home Lake, and to his family's delight, his bid was accepted. In our first visit to our new holding, my father met an old trapper and hunter on the lake named Joe. Joe was starting to build summer cabins for new people on the lake, people like us. He had a small crew of workmen from the local area, and he was opening a small trading post. Dad and Joe negotiated for our new cabin, and a deal was struck with a handshake. Nothing was put in writing. The cabin would be ready when we returned next summer. Well, right on schedule, we showed up with enough old furniture and other stuff to make the new cottage our summer home. Joe stopped by to say hello and to be sure Dad was happy with his work. Dad was happy, and he said so. Then he looked Joe in the eye and asked if he was happy with the deal. Joe said, "Well, Larry, I didn't do well here. I lost money. I underestimated the cost to carry all the lumber up over the cliffs." Dad didn't blink an eye and asked, "Joe, would another $800 cover your loss and give you a fair profit?" The man was startled. He hadn't met many landowners like my father. But this was the right thing to do on Dad's part, and as a businessman, he knew it was. Honestly, I think Dad, as an American, was a little uncomfortable in Canada. He wanted to feel good about his presence in the country. He was protecting his high self-image by doing the right thing. He was paying line for line, deed for deed. Dad was paying forward for a lifetime of service from Joe. We didn't have to worry about snow on the roof, that's for sure. Joe stayed in business on Go Home Lake and helped many other people with the small profit he earned from my father. My father did not need the self-satisfaction of getting every last dollar out of every last negotiation. He wanted fair value. If he knew he was getting such value, he was happy to pay full price. I'm the same way. Paying full price when justified empowers me to ask full price when justified. In this world, we do usually get what we pay for, remember. We also perform to the level of our self-image.